This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch the show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. Just as Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg is celebrating the 2 billion user mark for his social media outlet, an in-depth investigative report by ProPublica has found that Facebook's tools to filter out hate speech are deeply problematic. A series of internal documents obtained by the investigative media outlet found that Facebook identifies protected categories of people based on, quote, race, sex, gender identity, religious affiliation, national origin, ethnicity, sexual orientation, and serious disability or disease. But when users attack subsets of protected categories, there is a lot of leeway. Among the documents leaked were a set of slides that Facebook uses to train its army of monitors. One particularly damning slide displays three photos of female drivers, black children, and white men. The question asks, which of the below subsets do we protect? And the correct answer is apparently white men. My guest is Ramesh Srinivasan. He is the director of the Digital Cultures Lab and associate professor of information studies and design and media arts at the University of California, Los Angeles. And his book is called Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. Welcome to the program, Ramesh.
I'm so happy to be back, Sonali. Thank you for having me.
So first, it's interesting that, of course, these documents had to be leaked. You would think Facebook would be transparent about how it identifies hate speech and addresses it. But like its algorithm for how things appear in your feed, I suppose its hate speech policy is also sort of secret, even if its broad outlines are public. How do you think they arrived at this conclusion that broad protected categories of people deserve protection, but subsets of those categories don't?
Well, it's a real problem because it reflects, it's a policy that might seem useful or somehow philosophically or legally appropriate in theory, but it doesn't actually acknowledge the world as it stands, right? It's, you know, as you stated so clearly in the introduction to our interview, when you can use hate speech against a black child, but you can't against a white man, that doesn't necessarily mean that Facebook is racist or anti-child, but it does, in effect, create and perpetuate a system of inequality that we know exists. So I think Facebook is trying to be, they're certainly not being transparent here. Remember, we're talking about the largest global community, or so they claim, in the history of mankind on this platform. The public space, they claim, for the entire world to come together, but they're not being transparent on any level at all around why they're making the decisions they're making. They're clearly trying to follow a set of guidelines that consider race, that consider gender, but don't consider the specificities of these issues. So when you actually have the outcome where a refugee, specifically a Muslim refugee, is quasi-protected, meaning you could use degrading language toward that person or that group and say, kill them all, in the case of an Islamic radical or a purported Islamic radical, you actually have a system here where you're not only acknowledging the severity of the attack, but you're also not acknowledging the world as it stands.
So you're referring to the piece, the Facebook post by a U.S. congressman named Clay Higgins, who in after the Manchester attack in the UK posted to his Facebook page, hunt them, identify them, and kill them all for the sake of all that is good and righteous, kill them all. And Facebook monitors did not flag that post, at least not right away. And yet we hear, at least anecdotally, I've heard this among those people who are in my Facebook community, who are Black Lives Matter activists, who have their posts flagged and or their accounts suspended. In fact, ProPublica singled out the case of Didi Delgado, a Black Lives Matter activist, whose post that said, all white people are racist, start from this reference point or you've already failed. The word racist was flagged out as as something derogatory. Is that something that you have found even in your circles to be true, that posts by Black Lives Matter activists are flagged, whereas white supremacists aren't?
And other activists as well. So what's happening here is the severity of the threat is not being acknowledged in the flagging, but the category of the threat is instead. So that what's actually occurring is when you try to make a large-scale statement, but it's somehow, you know, sort of framed as being about Muslim terrorists or whatever you want to call it, and you say, I want to kill them all, that's a hard, you know, that's an incredibly intense threat to actually make, to make a statement around. But to say that white people are racist in contrast to that is a far less, you know, sort of inflammatory or incendiary statement, yet that is being counted and flagged in this case. So this is something where a set of rules are not being correctly articulated. They're clearly not being communicated as to us at all. And what those rules are and how they're being derived and applied is a huge problem here. Because again, as I'm stating, it's not acknowledging the world as it is. It's not acknowledging the truths around the persecution of Black people, the killings of Black children, of Black people, and it's trying to set us. There are a set of statements that are being kind of operated upon here that exist in some sort of world that doesn't exist, where all people are actually treated equally. So that's not justice, and it's certainly not transparent.
So basically, the set of slides that ProPublica actually recreated. Is really interesting. For example, they have one slide, protected category plus attack equals hate speech, and then a number of other slides that it uses to train its Facebook monitors, thousands of these monitors. So protected category has to be a very broad category, like white men. I'm assuming white women or Black men is another, these are also protected categories, but Muslim refugees wouldn't be, because that's a subset?
Is not. It actually recently became a quasi-protected category, but a quasi-protected category can be a denigrating language and very dismissive language, and I would say hateful language can actually be applied to a quasi-protected category, whereas it cannot to their protected categories. This is such a convoluted system. It's illogical. It doesn't accept the world as it is. Not being communicated to us.
It seems though it's literally saying that we will only protect broad categories of people, but we will not protect minorities, which are exactly the categories of people that need protecting. Historically, the world over, it's minorities who have been the ones who, you know, need protecting, not the big, broad sort of descriptors of large groupings of people. So it seems as though it's by its nature designed to fail minorities. But who designed this? As far as you know, I mean, is Facebook consulting with social scientists, or are they just making this up as they go along?
It's very, very hard to know. I mean, you don't have to be a social justice activist to know the data on disproportionate amounts of violence that are being directed at minority groups. And if you choose to apply the same sort of universalist, or I might say normative, categories toward people of color, toward refugees, you're actually perpetuating the problem. And the reason why you're perpetuating the problem is you're not understanding the realities that those specific communities are experiencing as it stands. But to your point, it's very, very unclear. I actually know the journalist who broke this story. He also broke the story on Cambridge Analytica that and the uses of data by the Trump campaign to use psychologically targeted advertising on American voters. You cannot be the public space of the world if something were to ever exist. I think that's inherently problematic. You can't claim to be the global community of the world and not actually listen to or communicate with its globally diverse constituencies. And part of communicating with and learning from globally diverse communities is actually trying to understand the world as it actually is, and understanding that if anything, the people most at risk today are Muslim youth. If anything, the people most at risk today are Black youth, and specifically Black men and women, and that is protected, but not youth for some reason, right? Hmm. If anything, people most at risk are refugees, who are completely a vulnerable category.
Right.
So It seems that somehow there's some sort of normative, perhaps, let's say, dating back to the Enlightenment idea of normative categorical identity that's being drawn here. I mean, some of this reminds me of like Enlightenment era, like rational philosophy that I've read from like the 1800s. But this is not the world as it stands. And the other point, you know, I just want to keep hitting this point home, is if you choose to target a non-protected category, meaning a subset of a category, like a black child, and you say, kill a black child, that won't be taken off of Facebook. And the reason why is that category is not protected, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not the severity of the threat is not actually being acknowledged by Facebook here. So Facebook, again, like so many other things, they need to do better. We need to ask them for more. We need to demand accountability and social responsibility, because they are not, as we talked about before, they are not simply some sort of like technology platform that provides us with information. They are the face of media. We're talking about 2 billion people in the world who are using Facebook right
now. It's turned into a part of our public commons, essentially,
absolutely.
Whether Facebook and Zuckerberg like it or not.
I think they like it.
Yeah.
And I think they like it because it legitimates them and it provides them. They have passed advertising revenue of every radio station in the world put together.
Wow.
There are more Americans who get their news on Facebook than all other major news sources put together. They have succeeded on a financial and economic level. Now it's time for them to back up their discourse, back up their brand, and actually be accountable to their constituencies, to their users.
And there were only about 4,500 people monitoring these things. You know, if you're talking on the order of billions of people, each person posting multiple times a day, clearly not enough monitors. They're claiming they will double the number of monitors up to 7,500. I want to talk about the fact that we have in the White House today, you know, the president of the country himself using the kind of speech that many of us would like to see, you know, addressed or flagged on Facebook. ProPublica points out in this article that at one point, Trump's posts about his campaign proposal to ban Muslim immigration to the U.S. violated the company's written policies against calls for exclusion of a protected group. But the Wall Street Journal reported that Facebook exempted Trump's statements from its policies at the order of Mark Zuckerberg. Why should Trump be exempted? Who gives, you know, who decided that Facebook should have exceptions to its rules, even if those are the presidents of countries?
Well, this has everything to do with how companies are or are not regulated, the set of laws that they are beholden to or the lack thereof, and obviously the revolving door between our government and Silicon Valley executives, which you can see both in the context of the Democratic Party, as well as with, you know, Peter Thiel and others in the context of this current administration. It's incredible, actually. You know, after appearing on your show last time, I was on Morning Joe with Mika live, who was attacked in the most vile fashion by President Trump on Twitter just yesterday.
Mika Brzezinski,
and you know, and it's one of those things where it's, I believe that at the end of the day, the currency, this is my theory, the currency by which Facebook operates is our presence on the site. The more we're on the site, the more data we provide. The more data we provide, the more that data can be turned into an asset. The more those assets are provided, the more advertising revenue is generated. So if comments like what President Trump states about Muslims or banning Muslim immigration, things that might violate some internal corporate policy, might actually attract that much more attention to the site. And it certainly did, as we both remember at that time. We were all on Facebook, you know, in hysteria, being like, what is going on here? That actually serves the bottom line of the company much more so than some small internal policy that we, by the way, know nothing about and only are hearing about right now.
Right.
I do want to make one quick point about the labor practices of content moderators. And this is something that people actually rarely think about. These thousands, and as you said, only 4,500 people all around the world tend to be, they don't receive unionized contracts. They don't receive benefit labor. I highly doubt, though I'm not completely sure, that they receive living wages. These are people that whose labor is actually invisible, but their labor, as we see in this case, is so essential and so important to the functioning of a public space that follows certain types of ethical values. So this is a type of disguised labor, and in many cases, these forms of labor only exist because algorithms are not able to do this type of labor. So this is actually a form of labor that assists the machine, that assists the algorithm, that assists the myth of automation. But we're actually talking about disproportionately Black and brown bodies in parts of the global south that are actually part of these networks of invisible labor, much like call centers.
Well, Ramesh, I want to thank you for joining us today, and our audience can watch the interview we did with you earlier about our book on our website as well. Thanks so much. Good luck to you.
I love the show. Thank you for having me. Great to see you.
My guest is Ramesh Srinivasan, Director of the Digital Cultures Lab and Associate Professor of Information Studies and Design and Media Arts at UCLA. His book is called Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.